Welcome to another episode of The Week in IndyCar on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast presented by Cooper Tires. Honestly, I'm not sure if this is going to lead off the show or if I just repeated the intro for no purpose. We have two guests this week. One, Sebastian Bourdais, the French fry to my hamburger. And second, but definitely first in my heart as a fellow race engineer, Eric Bretzman, technical director at Andretti Autosport. How you doing, bud?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's always good to come off a win and get to go straight back to the racetrack in a couple days.
Yes. Who wants to sleep or rest? And you get to travel from California to Alabama. Everyone's logical tourist.
Oh, yeah. With a red eye in the middle that got delayed 3 hours and changed planes and all kinds of stuff.
Lucky you. Well, good to report, first of all. Thanks to everybody who has inquired how I am doing. My left eye is almost completely open. Swelling has gone almost completely down. I do have another week of nasty, well, at least their effects, Eric, nasty antiviral meds, antibiotics, and other stuff that wreaking havoc with my system. But, you know, that's the price you pay for being out and around, you dirty bastards at the racetrack and getting sick. But so if you haven't listened to The Week in IndyCar before, we tend not to just regurgitate news. We try and dive into the sport, do some analysis about what took place most recent races and news and such. And I figured having my old friend Eric on, who is a pretty key figure at Andretti Autosport, considering how they just whooped everybody last weekend at Long Beach with Alexander Rossi as the tippier spear. Let's talk about this to open a bit, Eric. So 2015, 2016 at Long Beach, I remember interviewing Michael Andretti, and he looked like someone had run over his dog. I mean, just the most down-in-the-mouth guy you can imagine on pit lane, because the Andretti Autosport team really, really did not excel in qualifying. I think 10th was about the best by one driver, but just about everybody was mired towards the back of the pack. And the one thing Michael said both years was, I don't get it. We're spending a fortune on our damper program, damper development program. Place like Long Beach really amplifies how well teams are doing in that department, and clearly Andretti Autosport was behind. Tell us a little bit about what we saw last weekend, Eric, because a lot of your competitors were really admiring Rossi and Hunter Ray and everybody's power down capabilities, so it's pretty clear that on the engineering front, which you're in charge of, damping's come a long way since you joined the team, and the overall engineering efforts have really taken a big step forward. Bring us inside that. How do you guys make that big of a turnaround in a relatively short amount of time?
Yeah, well, I guess we can preface that with, you know, 15 and 16 were the body kit years, right? So not everybody was playing with the same tool set on some of the first order principles with downforce and drivability on the aero side, for sure. You know, and making you have to work pretty hard to make up for some of the characteristics. But, you know, coming back to what we've got going on now, you know, all the same people are here. You know, there's a couple of us new guys added to the mix, but damper program's the same personnel. It was really just kind of, you know, floating some new ideas in and, you know, putting that in place last year at some tests. And I would say even from the start of last year, from St. Pete to Sonoma, pretty big changes along the way. I mean, I think you look and see how we finished last year. It was just leading to how we were going to start this year, to be honest. And we just had all winter to fine-tune a little bit. But like I say, you know, same personnel for the most part. You know, we've added myself and Jeremy along the way, but really, we started out analyzing what was here. Like, this team's been successful in the past. It has a good long history to it. There certainly isn't any reason to come in and just start throwing things out and starting over, or making it like this team or making it like that team, or, you know, how we used to do it type thing. So it was a little process for us to kind of relearn it together. Try some new ideas along the way, and you know, even at the end of last year, we were already looking up.
Let's talk about that a little bit. You mentioned Jeremy. That would be Jeremy Millis, who is, Alexander Rossi's engineer. Definitely have known him forever, and crazy guy, but crazily talented as well. Let's talk about something that Rob Edwards, the chief operating officer, is really, you know, hands-on in charge of running the team. We did a story in the preseason, Eric, where, you know, asked those questions. What have you guys done during the offseason to get better? What changes have you made? And by and large, he said everything you just mentioned. Look, we've got the pieces. The people are already here. It isn't a case of, oh boy, we're really stinking up the joint in this department. We've got to blow everybody out and go hire new people. It was, no, we've got the tools. And we made good progress in 2017. Two wins wasn't what we wanted. We wanted more, but the ingredients were here. It's just maybe figuring out how to come up with a better recipe, working with the same ingredients. For those who maybe understand the role of a race engineer, but maybe don't fully grasp what a technical director does like yourself, you tell us a little bit about that process, the reconfiguring the ingredients, suggesting a little bit more of this, a little bit less of that. Hey, instead of pureeing this one, why don't you mince it? You know, you're having to work with these ingredients, but how does someone in your role take a good base recipe and improve it to the point of what we've seen this year?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm still a work in progress. A year into this position, kind of did this a little bit down in the NASCAR world, but before that, it was just strictly race engineer position before that, where you use what you got and try and make it go the fastest. And I kind of look at it now where I'm trying to provide for the guys, what they need, whether they're asking for it or, hey, why don't you try this? It's great when the race engineers and the individual teams can get together and come to me and say, hey, we want to go this direction, and they're all behind it for good reason. And, that makes it real easy for me to get motivated to go find it, figure it out, get with the production guys, get with, Rob and find the budget for whatever that project may be. Some of it's nuts and bolts and parts and pieces, but then some of it's sitting down with the guys and saying, hey, you are doing the right thing. Maybe you just didn't get the right results this time, or maybe you just need to try it again over here, or tweak it a little bit, and keep everybody on, clear-minded, level-headed, and believe in themselves a little bit, right? So we're back to the same thing where, maybe we weren't getting results for years and years, or you just get far enough outside the window where every change you make just always seems to be worse. And just kind of help them sift through it and have a little confidence to get going the right direction and believe in it.
Let's drill down a little bit into a driver you and I discussed among ourselves at Phoenix, that being Alexander Rossi. You, I think a lot of us, or a lot of listeners, a lot of IndyCar fans would have gotten to know you as the man behind many, not all, but many of Scott Dixon's championships in IndyCar at Chip Ganassi Racing. And as we readily admit, Dixon is and has been the best of his generation. So you have more than a decade of experience of working with one of the all-time greats in IndyCar, have seen what makes him unique and special. Not asking or saying that Rossi has ticked any of those boxes yet. I mean, good Lord, he's barely, he's still finding his feet in IndyCar. But would I be safe in saying, as someone who has worked so closely with, I guess not just Dixon, but, Dario, you've worked with a lot of incredible drivers. Are you seeing some things in young Alexander Rossi that remind you, trait-wise or similar, that, he's given me some suggestions that there could be some similarity with some of the ones you've worked with before?
Yeah, shocking similarity. I see Alex developing into nearly the same guy on track.
Wow!
I've been very impressed just in the 16 or 18 months I've been around him, directly around him. It's crazy how they, in a lot of cases, say the same thing, ask about this. They're looking for the same thing a lot of the times. Like, the first thing out of his mouth at a certain type of track is, like, flashback.
That has to be uncanny, because most engineers, as you know, if you're fortunate, you get to work with two, like, supremely talented race car drivers in your career. I mean, they're all talented at this level, but I mean, you know, those where you're like, holy cow, this was a special treat. So to see already some similarities in Alexander and Dixon, that's pretty, not alarming, but just from a how often that happens in the career of someone like yourself. Yeah, you don't get too many invitations to that kind of talent.
Yeah, no, Watkins Glen really cemented it for me last year. I mean, that was our place back there for a lot of years in a row. I think we won three in a row, and then had a little incident under yellow that took us out of our fourth one in a row, maybe, and then we got some wing damage of another one. We were passing Helio for the lead on the back straight and ended up knocking the right front wing off or what have you. But, I mean, that was a place where Scott easily could have had five in a row. And, you know, he was always up front there, it seemed like, with plenty of speed. And, you know, to go there last year and watch Alex out-qualify him and then just plain beat him to line. And those two were, was it a 9 or 12-second gap back to third or something, right? They both just checked out.
Yep.
So, you know, there's same tracks, same characteristics, same result. Like, I've been pretty impressed.
So tell me a little bit about working with some of the other folks there. Last weekend, the Cartoon Anvil had, you know, some sort of laser sighting device on Hunter Ray's car during those 85 laps on Sunday. I mean, you just started to feel like bad for the guy. Like, just pull in, brother, because something else is going to happen. A street light's going to fall over and hit the rear wing, and, you know, a freaking badger's going to run across the track. I mean, it was getting to be uncomfortably comical. But tell us a little bit about what you've seen in Ryan Hunter Ray. I mean, we know the guy's a champ. We know he's an Indy 500 winner, but curious your, you know, outsider or somewhat newcomer appraisal of you know, longstanding Andretti team leader.
Yeah, the dude is tough, man. Yeah, they drop the green flag. It doesn't care. You know, it doesn't matter what position he's starting in. He's going to do something. You know, he keeps either, you know, bad things happening to him or making a mistake here or there and going to the back, and he comes right back through again. It's been pretty impressive to watch. You know, he's got a ton of miles under his belt and, you know, a lot of testing over his career, right? So he's got a pretty good view for all the tracks we go to. You know, you kind of talk about Alex, but I think he doesn't have double digit starts on short ovals yet, right? And Ryan's awesome on short ovals. I've been really impressed with him there. But, man, if you only gave me one word, I would just say tough.
Wow.
Like, yeah, I've been super impressed. I mean, like, he got sent to the back at Long Beach, drove back up to fifth. You know, he drove forward in so many races last year. You know, but the last couple of races, yeah, we just got to avoid the mistakes over there. And he's been every bit as fast as Alex. He was at Phoenix. He was at Long Beach. You know, it's just a qualifying penalty here or there, you know, and little issue here and there. And it's something we talk about here, and I remind all the guys of, you know, when something starts going sideways a little bit, it's really hard to stop it, right? Like, you know, you get one little qualifying penalty, and suddenly, instead of starting in the top four or five, you're starting at the back or at the back of one of the groups, right? Now you have all this higher probability of having an issue getting to the front, you know, and it's just hard to turn that around, right? So, you know, execution on the track, execution building the car, right, for you know, trying to avoid DNFs, you know, execution is, you know, it's really hard to put it back on the right track when it starts going wrong.
Let's cover off on the other two IndyCar drivers. Obviously, we have a rookie in Zach Veach, who finished fourth on Sunday. Really impressive. I think that was I realize he's a rook, so IndyCar fans who, you know, haven't had a chance to see a lot of Mazda Road to Indy races might not have a sense for who Zach is as a driver. But in watching him on Sunday, that to me was a classic Zach Veach drive, based on everything I've seen him do in the lower categories. Smart, heady, really determined, fast, but also not making stupid mistakes, not venturing out into areas where the risk reward ratio was definitely way off. Have you had a feel for not only this kid's intelligence, but also that kind of on-track smarts that seems to at least be demonstrated in his finish last weekend?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Like, even at Long Beach, he had a couple of shots to do some pretty scary things to get a podium and you know, wisely chose to hold back a bit, and, you know, he ended up where he ended up there in fourth. So, you know, he's not out there just hanging on. You know, he's thinking about things and sees the big picture. And, you know, we've been focused on just getting miles with him, especially in the race conditions. You know, it's so hard for the kids these days coming in versus a Dixon and a, you know, Helio and Tony and all these guys that, you know, we used to test 30 or 40 days a year and, you know, tens and tens of thousands of miles, right? And we got 3 days at Sebring and they said, go for it. So, you know, he's for him to have passed the people he was passing and run where he was running, and he's only got, you know, two handfuls of days in an Indy car, and to throw him in the walls, you know, between the walls at Long Beach at 180 miles an hour, I was really impressed.
So Marco Andretti is a topic that, I mean, Marco doesn't come up a ton on our show, but when he does come up, it's usually under some sort of, if Marco is having a clear day mentally and is focused and does not allow the distractions to pull him out of that mindset, he can be incredibly effective. I think that's the guy that I saw on Sunday finishing sixth. I mean, rounding off three drivers in the top six for Andretti Autosport. What have you seen with him? I mean, along with the Dixons of the world, who seemingly could fall out of bed 5 minutes before the checkered and go win the thing, you also have some drivers who, like Marco, I'm sure you've worked with, Eric, who have a lot of talent. Talent's never been the question with Marco, but it's the ability to tap into that on a consistent basis. Do you think we're seeing something with Marco that might lead him more in that direction of that tapping in and putting in quality finishes?
Yeah, I think so. I think ending up at the top of the board on Sunday, even, you know, just one race at Long Beach, all that helps him build his confidence to know he's doing the right thing, and you know, that there's a payoff here, right, for adapting to this new car and you know, kind of dialing the style in a little bit. But yeah, you're right. When you look back and when we go to tracks now where, you know, we chose to send him to be our representative at the Texas test, like, he's got a ton of experience. You know, and he was our guy last year at the Texas test. You know, that place he's been around a million times, you know, mind you, they've changed the track, and that's the guy we sent to help best adapt our team, to that track. Like, he's an asset, you know, in a lot of ways. But yeah, we definitely got to keep him, you know, upbeat, knowing he's doing the right thing, you know, getting it applied at the track every weekend, and you know, kind of give him the freedom to try some things here and there, and, you know, learn from the other drivers, and you know, kind of play to some of his concerns as well, right? You know, we've got some strong feedback coming in from Alex, and strong feedback coming in from Ryan in all his years, but, you know, Marco's got a ton of miles in these same types of cars, right? It's, you know, DW12, you know, back 10, 12 years now, he's been doing this with roughly the same power, roughly the same wheelbase. And, you know, for most of those years, it was only two or three cars. So there's a ton to be learned, you know, by us still, you know, from him and testing with him. So yeah, he's part of the team.
Let's switch gears here, Eric, and we're gonna jump into some more Long Beach stuff, but I kind of want to continue the theme, and thank you again for not only sharing an hour with us in a very busy and compact week for you, but so you now have to play your role in helping the team to get ready for a race, you know, or you're on track 5 days after you're completing Long Beach. First trip to a natural terrain road course in Barber. What is it like for you and your fellow engineers getting cars prepared for a road course visit, first proper road course. Is this strictly a numerical exercise at this, you know, at this point in the week? All right, we're going to want this setup on the car and this center of pressure to start off and blah, blah, blah. How much of this is working with drivers, coaching them up a bit on, hey, this is how we're going to start. We're going to want you to kind of venture off in this direction setup-wise, and you go over here. Just curious how much at this stage between events is the numbers, the mechanical part, and how much of this is kind of team-based, prepping drivers and assistant engineers and otherwise for what you guys are going to, your strategy to go succeed next weekend.
Gosh, yeah, I hope our guys aren't working too much on Barber right now. I think we're probably working on Indy Oval and a couple things a few weeks from now. But
sure.
Yeah, we preseason are able to look ahead a little bit, right, because we had the Barber open test. So most of our simulation, most of our driver in the loop simulator days would have happened pre-Barber and then post-test already. So we've already got a pretty good picture of all the fundamentals in place. We would have rig tested, we would have, done any of our damper simulation, virtual rig tests already. Now we're just kind of, taking some of our new ideas or updates to the actual car, some of the components that have kind of developed since St. Pete and integrating those. But, like I say that, foundation of it's kind of already, maybe 3-4 weeks ago, kind of already in place. This week we'll kind of be divvying out some of the key items, maybe for two cars to test in the first session, item one, item two, and two cars to test item three, item four, and then we can get back together after the first practice and kind of see how that went and pick a direction. I would say this week we're just kind of merging in some of the just generic developments of the car, and then kind of maybe splitting up what we think are the key test items, the biggest bang for the buck, the ABAs we want to get done right away.
So ABAs, that is a great expression that I don't think fans get to hear that much. Can you explain that? And I could explain it, but not as well as you. But that's if we're talking about testing, and what Eric's referring to is, the team will have very specific run plans for each of the four cars once free practice one starts on Friday at Barber. As he mentioned, some cars will, drivers and cars will be asked to go in a certain direction test-wise, others in a different. Everyone will huddle up after the session, first session and second session, and get a feel for what worked, what didn't, build a stronger idea of what they want to do in the following sessions. But during that session, the old ABA testing, that is it's a system. Can you explain to our listeners what that is?
Yeah, well, in a perfect world, you would do a baseline run, maybe at Barber, just with the way the tires kind of start to degrade after a couple laps, or the driver, once the driver's up to speed and repeatable on lap time, you would call that your baseline run. So that would give you an index of a lap time, tire pressures, aero balance, a lot of key metrics that we look at. Then in the pit lane, we would change ideally one variable. It'd be front wing angle or aero balance, maybe could be spring rates, could be heave rates, heave gaps, cambers, just try and dial it into a concept. It could be all four cambers, but that would just be the concept. And we would go out and do that same length of run until the lap time's kind of stabilized. It could be a four lap run. And then what we would do, because now you've got a little degradation on the tire, maybe the track's rubbered in a little bit, we would ideally, in a perfect world, go back. So we would have our A configuration as the baseline. B would be the change of, ideally one variable we've isolated. And then we would put that back and rerun the baseline just to make sure, track conditions, ambient, maybe the driver getting accustomed to the track, right, or finding some way to go over a curb differently or something, right, and just make sure that repeats. So on test days, you find yourselves doing that a lot. On race days or race weekends and those 45-minute practices, boy, sometimes you only get two or three runs in a 45-minute practice. So you end up doing AB a lot.
Well,
never quite making it back home.
I won't mention his name, but there was a driver that I worked with in Indy Lights, and let's just say that privately we called him Mr. AB, 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 because he couldn't tell you a damn thing. We could have fitted the rear tires to the front. I don't think he would have noticed. And so, we would go out, as you mentioned, do a baseline, the A, make a change, which was the B, come in, what do you think? And instead of saying, well, it felt like this or that, his immediate response was, can we go back to A? I don't know if I really noticed what it was. And we go back to A. You think we go back to B? It was just this back and forth. And ultimately, we learned, like, okay, we're just going to have to look at the stopwatch and kind of there's going to be some intuition involved, because we could spend all day going from A and B and A and B, and the driver wasn't going to get us to where we wanted to be. But well, let's look at Long Beach and some of the questions. Well, granted, we do have some listener questions that have come in on these topics, so we might cover off a few of those here. But definitely a couple of questions that many folks have been asking. One was about the timing of pit stops. We know that with Alexander and the decision on the final pit stop when he was brought in, that those who were pursuing him were hoping to gain some lap time while Alexander's car was heavy on fuel and tires weren't necessarily all the way up to temp. And Mr. Bourdais and Mr. Dixon ended up getting caught out by a yellow and then had subsequent problems with Dixie's team providing service while the pits were closed. Bourdais drove through, which was smart, but he still lost track position there. What's the mindset, Eric, when you know you have a good car, like you guys did and like Bourdais and Dixon, and the window's open for that final stop? You obviously have two directions to go. Alexander's proved to be the right one. Let's get in somewhat early. Make sure, we're not hung out by anything. And then there are those who say, well, we think we could find an advantage by running a little bit longer. But since Rossi has stopped, the clock is ticking on possibly getting caught out by a yellow. Do you feel bad when something like that happens to other teams who stay out, quote, too long and get caught out? And what's the methodology for deciding, you know, is it worth staying out and the risk there of getting caught out or catching up? I don't know, man. It seems like everyone seems like it should follow Rossi in, but I wonder if there's a greater mindset at play of how to approach such things.
Yeah, and Alex was in a unique situation. He was in a unique situation to Scott and Sebastian. Alex was able to pull a big enough gap to cover coming out on cold tires. He was also in a good situation in that he was able to pit into a 10-second gap. So he was going to be able to run full speed up to the cars that, you know, he had 10 seconds worth of track to make up some time and to just go hard before he'd run into slower cars that would slow him down while he got around him. And that was just about the right amount of time that Bourdais and Dixon were going to be able to run before they had to stop.
Mm.
So it was absolutely perfect combination. As long as Alex could keep doing the pace and nobody made any mistakes, there really wasn't a risk. Like we pit into a gap. We had a big enough gap to absorb the physical track position coming out on cold tires, to when those guys would cycle through. So, you know, you get that 3 or 4 second gap, and that's really all the cushion you need, as long as you can get those primary tires up and start throwing down some lap times on your first full time lap. And pitting into a gap is a huge thing. So all in all, you know, and as we caught the cars that Alex was catching, they would come into their pit window and they started getting out of his way anyway. If you were in the position of Scott and Sebastian, you're either going to, you're going to have to make a decision. You're either going to take some kind of epic flyer to make up the 4 or 5 seconds that Alex was up the road and put yourself at risk. Or at some point you just have to say, hey, I'm racing this guy that's right in front of me. We'll either just go one lap shorter than him or one lap further than him, or you know, kind of assess the situation and take a smaller bite out of it. You know, we were kind of looking back at history, and you know, I lived it with Scott. I mean, we could have had 10 or 15 more wins that we got hung out on. It's only because the guy could make fuel mileage so well.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, he's making the same lap time as everybody else, and everybody starts pulling off the track, and you're like, huh, we can go another 3 or 4 laps, and then, you know, somebody makes a mistake coming out of the pits on cold tires, and then we go to the back. You know, so it's not new to Scott. Like, I know he and I went through it for sure. And, you know, Long Beach has a pretty heavy history of peak yellow percentage at the pit windows for that very reason, right? Guys are getting racy coming out of the fountain or into the fountain on cold tires, and there's a yellow. So, you know, Alex was in a position where he just didn't need to take the risk.
So let's get your thoughts before we jump into Q&A here. Sebastian Bourdais' instruction from race control to give his position back after running over, well over, the pit exit lanes. Sorry, as I struggle with words coming out my mouth. This was another fun topic that folks have definitely debated. Where do you fall? And we're not trying to get you fined here, so I'm not trying to get you in any trouble. But it seemed to be a question of, you know, it didn't look like Seb had any intent on driving over there on his own. It definitely looked like Dix, who rightfully wanted to defend the position, moved over about a car length. Seb moved to the right as well in reaction. What comes to mind when you see stuff like that and a penalty that follows? Is it, hey, letter of the law, who cares, you know, why you were there, you shouldn't have been there? Or do you think the extenuating circumstances might have been factored a little more heavily and let the pass of the year? I don't know what we should call it, by the way. The crossover? Maybe that's something listeners, we need a hashtag. Hashtag the crossover, hashtag the slash. I don't know what it was, but amazing pass. Just a little bit unfortunate to see he was told to give it back. But what comes to mind when you see that? Is it letter of the law or an exception, maybe?
Letter of the law, for sure. Maybe that could have been emphasized in the driver's meeting as saying, hey, there's a concrete wall there. Just, you know, you're not going over the line. It's just like there was a concrete wall there. But, yeah, I mean, you've seen it before with the, you know, the tin tops with the what's out of bounds, what's not out of bounds. Did you get forced out of bounds? I don't know. That starts making, you know, you've got some, not arbitrary, but, you know, people actually have to make judgment calls on that type of stuff. I know we just got bit for it a couple races back in supercars where we had one of our drivers take a little too much curb and it set a sensor off that said the car was too far over the curbing, and that was it. Lost the lap time in qualifying. You know, mm-hmm. It was totally no judgment call. You know, the light turns on and that car that just went over, it's out. I like taking the judgment out of it a little bit.
Yeah.
Because that'll at least make it consistent. I mean, it was cool to watch, but coming from somebody that used to do some track days down at Barber, which I think is a reasonably dangerous pit in and pit out in the world of motorsports, and you know, I've had some surprise handlebars end up in my side in the middle of cornering from some other motorbike that was going in and out of the pits straight onto the line. I really don't have a lot of patience for people jumping those lines in the, you know, that are there for safety.
Well,
it's like a crosswalk. You know, you still got to look both ways, though, to be honest, right? A you know, 32nd of an inch of paint's not going to stop you from getting hit. So, it's just an awkward situation.
You know what I can't wait for, Eric? Asking the same question to Sebastian Bourdais. I wonder which direction he's going to lean, boys and girls. Pure mystery. No clue where he's going to take that conversation.
Yeah.
Well, let's...
I wonder what he would have thought about it if he was making that pass, if there were 4 or 5 cars racing out the end of pit lane that just in the middle of a pit sequence.
you know, there you go, being intelligent again. Come on, Bretzman, join the dummies like me. Don't start bringing intelligence into this. Well, let's go ahead and dive into some Q&A. And as we do every week, we thank our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com for a fun little thing they do, Eric, where they let me choose my favorite question from the previous week. And provided that person reaches out through Facebook, direct message with an answer back, they send them either a Marshall Pruitt Podcast t-shirt or mug or something. I got to get you a t-shirt so you can use that when you're wiping down the motorcycle next time you go and hit the mud. I'm going to give the award here to Steve Kowalczyk, who closed off last week's episode with Mike Hull with a great question of, have you ever seen a driver with a case of the yips? And that was a really fun conversation. So Steve, hit me here on Facebook with a DM. Let me know if you're wanting a t-shirt or a mug, and hit me with your email address and your mailing address, and we'll get you taken care of. But let's kick off here. Actually, Eric, we're going to go to Twitter for our first question. And this, I think, comes back to one thing that was raised with Dixon going through the pits and then stopping for service and a little bit of the confusion there. Bill Ryan asks, how are teams notified? That's, you know, I make up new words each week. This week it's notified. Bill asks, how are teams notified that the pits are closed? He says, I know teams monitor race control on radio, but Michael mentioned something on a monitor or screen. Thanks in advance. And if you didn't get a chance to watch the broadcast after the race, Eric, Mike had mentioned that there was a screen or an SMS note from IndyCar that they were cleared a pit. Then after the race, Dixie said that might have been left over from the previous pit open sequence and errantly up for them to see and errantly think they could pit. But share with folks how teams are notified from IndyCar Race Control that, yep, pits are open, or nope, pits are closed.
Yeah, actually, there's a ton of ways now. I'm just thinking back to, like, even just 5 years ago. You know, it was a little bit of a jumpy situation to know, if, you know, if you were leading, right, you never wanted to accidentally pass the pits that were open. If you were meant to pit, right, you'd give up all your track position, right? So you'd be listening to Race Control to start out with. Then you've got the pit techs on pit lane saying open or closed. But the ones where independently you can know for yourself, there's a light system that's connected to the track radios, track lights, that is actually hanging in our timing stands. I think all the teams have them now. And that'll go, there's a yellow light on there that'll go on and off depending on the pit open or closed condition. At the end of pit lane, and I remember seeing it on Bourdais' in-car camera before he even pulled off the track. Like, he was still clearly on the track with time to bail out, and the yellow light was on at the end of pit lane for the drivers to see. The timing and scoring software that I think all the teams use, the same software, and some people might write their own, but it's available in the data stream from the series. Giant yellow box says pits open, pits closed. So you can follow that. Then there is an instant message system as well that the series runs, and it's a bi-directional system, so we can actually ask race control questions if we want to via kind of, you know, SMS message, just a keyboard on a laptop. And every time your car comes into the pit lane and hits one of the initial timing lines, you know, the pit timing line, it'll actually do an automatic message that says, you know, in the case of Alex, said 27 good to pit, or 27 drive through, with your car number. So it, you know, there's a lot of methods. So, and they all trigger off the same thing, best I can tell. So, I mean, you know, the only possible, failure method would be the human getting involved in broadcasting over the radio on race control that, you know, mistakenly one way or the other, but I think the digital systems are all tied together.
Damn humans. All right, Dan Glass. Now, this could be today's version of Pandora's Box. Dan says, what areas of the car would Eric like to see opened up next? And how large an increase in engine power would he like to see? and how would he go about it? So you got a triple threat of technical questions for you, Mr. Bretzman, from Dan Glass.
Wow, okay. You might have to remind me as we go, but I can tell you a couple of those go together. The more power question kind of goes with the development on the brake system and brake cooling. I don't believe we're in a position to go any faster down the straightaways with our cars getting as heavy as they are without having to go into development on brake systems. We're tapped out. Matter of fact, Detroit's going to be difficult for everybody, I think. So I would say, you know, if we did another 100 or 150 horsepower, heck, I think if you did 50 horsepower, we'd be in big trouble with the brakes on two or three tracks. So I would say some of that's going to have to go hand in hand, and it's going to have to go hand in hand with budget. That's kind of how we got to where we are as a series, is trying to keep the budget for the brakes somewhat under control, where we don't have guys developing really expensive carbon brake packages, you know, three or four different developments, you know, throughout the series, you know, throughout a season. There's long lead times on that, minimum orders. You know, we've got four cars to outfit. It certainly wouldn't be cheap, but we would have to do something if we're going faster. Either the car's got to get a lot lighter, or we're going to have to do something on the brake side.
How about methodology of increasing power? And I'll mention that I don't think I'm going to publish it this week, because although my eye is mostly opened, there's a reason I'm doing a fair amount of podcasts than writing stories, because it's a lot easier to talk and drop the audio into the little podcast template I have in my editing software than to write stories, because both eyes aren't working perfectly. But when my eyes do come back to work, I have a little story I'm working on how IndyCar gets to 900 horsepower. But if Eric Bretzman was given the rule book to say how we get to that number here in a couple years with the next engine formula, what comes to mind on that bump of approximately 150 horse to get to 900?
Well, I guess I'd have to look straight at the turbo side, and, you know, that's assuming we stay with the turbo engines. I'm sure that the guys at Honda and Chevy are probably better suited to answer the question as far as feasibility of just cranking some more boost to it versus what's going to fail first and cost a lot. I think we could go that route and not add a whole lot of weight. The six-cylinder thing seems to be staying here. Could you go to a V8 and keep the turbo package and just up to an eight-cylinder? Maybe that's the way to go. Right now we're in a different world than we were the last time we did this. We've got it written in the rule book. We got to go 2,500 miles an hour. We used to be putting in engines for 50 miles for qualifying and pulling them out. They were done, right? So it's a new world. With the cars in the series and the budgets the way they are, and just kind of the way the world is working now, right? I don't see us going back to 50 mile engines anymore. So I think we really just have to look at, do we just need to add some more cylinders to spread the load out? Or can we put a little more boost, relatively inexpensive, through turbos, you know, into the system, and maybe the engine mileage goes down to 1500 and we replace bearings, rods, and try and keep as many of the expensive bits intact for as many events as possible. But, maybe some combination of that. If we have to spread the load out, it wouldn't hurt my feelings going back to a V8. That's kind of natural instinct, but that's because that's the way it was for so many years. But hey, maybe we can put a little more boost to it and still kind of keep our longevity.
It's like you've read what I've put together already for the piece, Eric, but that's why I love you. You're smart in the head. All right, we're going to move over to Facebook here. Daniel Kincaid, interesting. And again, hopefully you can... I've held two of these three positions. I've never been a technical director, because most teams are smart enough to realize that would be a surefire way to move to the back of the grid. But Daniel asks, what's the major differences between a technical director to a race director to an assistant engineer? I'm sorry, to a race engineer to an assistant engineer. He says, for the most part, I understand what the race engineer role is, but how do the other two come into play in a race weekend?
Yeah, so the race engineer position, you know, is kind of the key guy for that driver and car number, for that entry. He's coordinating what the rest of the shop and guys like me are making available and kind of fine-tuning those bits and pieces that are available with the best settings they can come up with, optimized for that driver, that track, at that moment, that set of tires. So, you know, he's the go-to guy right there. The assistant engineer is looking after kind of all the, I guess you'd say, the engineering tools. The stuff we deal with the most on our side of the building over here, that would be the data acquisition system, the calibrations for those sensors, even all the way down to the fuel. They're typically looking after how much fuel is in the car, how far we can go. They're handling the data for the fuel strategy in the race. But, you know, in our case now, we've got those guys looking after those tools and looking after the fuel probes and looking after the hoses and the tanks. And, you know, no different than we ask the mechanics to look after their tools and their tool chest. So that's kind of what the assistant engineer does. They're typically assigned to a car number, you know, an entry, just like the race engineer. But when they're back at the shop, they all have kind of their own areas of expertise. You know, different race or assistant engineers will be in charge of different development projects, different parts of the or sections of the reporting or pre-event studies that we do. It's the same with the race engineers. Each one of our race engineers is kind of a key guy or a point of contact for one for aero, one for shock development, one for driveline and simulation, and another for just kind of generic, you know, car build. That you know, we're doing everything as well as we can on the car build side, and that all the engineering group stays in touch with what the car chiefs and the mechanics are doing with the cars.
And I mean, the assistant race engineer too, that phraseology is not new, but it is almost somewhat new. I mean, back in my day, the assistant engineer was usually referred to as the DAG, and I, you know, that term is still used, the data acquisition geek, but, it seems like, you know, the parlance has changed a little bit for the role, but the role has also expanded enough to where, you know, few teams have what you would just call a traditional data geek who just looks after the data and isn't really, you know, carrying more weight in many of the areas that you just mentioned. So I would say that's probably the reason why, instead of, you know, data engineer being the term, assistant engineer seems to be more fitting, because it covers more roles that most folks are asked to maintain in that position today.
Yeah, and we honestly had that position and still sort of do. We had essentially three guys per entry. So we had a race engineer, an assistant engineer, and a traditional DAG up until this year. You know, I had never actually run with that system. Last time I ran with that system probably would have been 02 in the kind of end of the cart days. Yeah. Back at the old place. And we've moved away from that this year. Put a little bit more in the hands of the assistant engineer. You know, they're the ones making a lot of the decisions with the data coming off the car. And now we've put them more in direct contact with and responsibility for making sure that data is accurate that's coming off the car. What it's done is it's allowed us to, we've moved those DAGs we've had inside the company. And we now have them in systems engineer position. So we send two to the track to support, you know, any major issues, right? Like if we have to change a chassis loom, or we've got an accident, or we got to swap cars, or, you know, there's some fundamental issues, right? We've got more hands on deck besides just the assistant engineers to jump on it. But that is their expertise, and their profession is doing loom repairs and, you know, really getting their hands on the parts. But that's freed up two guys to stay back at the shop and start finally getting us ahead. You know, we used to travel a ton of people. So now we've cut out quite a bit of folks on the travel staff, and we come home on Monday mornings and there's parts sitting here waiting for us, and spares have been made, and things are repaired, and it's given us a little momentum when we get back Mondays.
Amen to that. Well, we are starting to wind down for the end of the hour that you were able to make available for us, Eric. So let me grab a couple of final questions. I can answer this one, but I'll throw it at you. Nick Falkowitz asks, for Marshall, can you explain what they were downloading into Wiccan's car when they were trying to fix his misfire issue? And again, I don't know if you got a chance to see that, but I know that it was initially described as a misfire, but it sounded like it was more of a gearbox issue and gearbox electronics not talking to the control systems there, connecting the power coming out of the motor through the input shaft, heading out to the gearbox, and they plugged in. It appeared that they were, you know, quote, resetting or sending a new config file to the GCU, but when you have something like a gearbox that is giving the electronic middle finger to its friends on the other side of the equation, what are you guys doing on the timing stand connecting, trying to rectify or you know, overwrite, etc.?
Yeah, the first thing we commonly do now, the electronic system's gotten really complex. There's a lot of three-letter acronyms with CU at the end, control units, and they all have to talk to each other over multiple CAN streams, and a lot of times those failures will occur from things getting out of sync with each other, or an error code from one thing on the CAN stream, the next couple things down the line in the CAN stream will fail. You know, in that case, it could have been as simple as the GCU just thinking it was in neutral, and whenever the engine says or gets the report that it's in neutral, it has a neutral rev limiter that's not as high as what it would be in a gear on track. So it could have felt like a misfire, right? It was just a limiter.
Yeah.
So the engine thought it was doing the right thing, but it wasn't because the GCU was passing it bad information. So, you know, just a power reset and let everything handshake and initialize again is a common fix. But when you plug into the car like that, you'll try and send a new configuration file to it and effectively restart some of the boxes, and they'll look for that initial handshake and get initialized again and start sending reliable data again. So yeah, it's kind of twofold. One, you'll likely resend a file to it, and two, you'll actually pull the logged data off the car, and you'll be able to dig through it real quick and look for the errors where they've been flagged in the data, and kind of zoom in and see what happened. You know, did something overheat? Did something overcurrent? You know, some of the fail safes that are in there, you'll just see what got triggered.
All right, couple more here to round up, and these are all direct for you engineering type stuff. So I know that you enjoy this part of the game here. So Michael Goodyear asks, can Eric explain some of the differences or difficulties involved with transferring over to Chip Ganassi's NASCAR team after his tenure as Scott Dixon's engineer in IndyCar? What was it like as an experienced engineer having to come to grips with a totally different setup, rule book, unfamiliar tracks? He says, obviously you weren't starting from scratch as an engineer, and also Chip's team is always strong, but he'd be curious to hear about what that personal engineering transformation process was like.
Well, you know, the going to work there every day part wasn't too difficult, right? It's the same boss, the building looks the same, could even wear the same clothes. Funny part was I actually knew probably half a dozen of those guys from 20-something years back when I was interning for Andy Petrie and the NASCAR series when I was in college. So
yep.
I had some stock car background before getting there, but it was back in the relatively prehistoric days to the CFD and wind tunnel they've got going on now. But, you know, it was – they have a bunch of great guys there. You can see it in their results now. You know, it's just – it's really, really busy down there. It's different than IndyCar racing. They are a production car company as much as they are a race team, right? I mean, that team, I think when I was there, was 240-something people, give or take, which
wow.
is relatively small for a top-running NASCAR team. It's actually pretty darn small. You know, it's half or third the size of a Gibbs and a Hendrick and a Childress. So those guys are doing a lot with what they've got down there. but, you know, 16 or 18 of us would leave and go to the racetrack or the test every weekend, and we'd come back, but there was still 220 people building race cars as fast as they could. And that's from scratch. That's from, you know, some of the parts are stamped now, but that's from relatively flat metal and round bar stock to rolling race cars. You know, we've got a lot of parts that's come out of a catalog nowadays here, you know, and the IndyCar teams, we used to do that too. We used to have update kits, or, you know, used to mod our floors or come up with another wing package, right? That's, you know, IndyCar used to be like that, but I think you'll find NASCAR going that way over the next couple of years, just with budgets and things. But, I'm glad I had the experience. They say it was good to work with a lot bigger group of people than I'd been familiar with on the IndyCar side. Lot of clever ideas, lot of energy down there. Those guys never stop. They are on all the time, and they have a really long season. They build more cars in a year than we'll ever have Indy cars in the next 40 years. So it's really fast paced, lots of great ideas. There's a lot of energy in down there going into, like I say, wind tunnel CFD design. And you get to race every week. You know, if you're into racing every week, that's, you get a chance to do it.
If you've got demons in your head or had a bad childhood and want to run away from your problems, NASCAR is the place for you. Now, Eric, should we tell folks the real reason that Michael Andretti hired you was to lead a new top secret Alfa Romeo NASCAR program, or should we keep that under wraps?
Holy smokes. Would they let an Alfa Romeo into NASCAR?
If they were spending money, they would let Hyundai into NASCAR. All right, my friend, we've got two more questions here. I'm going to save the best one for last, and no disrespect here, Robbie Bergren, for not being yours. Says, hi, Eric. Can you give as deep a description as possible for what you were doing when you, quote, throw the kitchen sink at a setup? And this obviously happens when, for whatever reason, whether it's going into qualifying or going into the race, whatever you've been doing hasn't been working, and you really are trying to come up with a miracle. He says, is it an educated guess, changing a lot of inputs, or bolting on a teammate setup that has been more successful? What's the general process of, all right, we're ripping up the script and going off book here and trying some crazy stuff to get in the window? How does that process usually happen for you, or you think most race engineers?
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal is to never get there, right? The goal is always to be a couple steps ahead, trying to make it a little bit better and get it to the point where, hey, okay, we're a 10th place car this week. If we stay out of trouble, maybe we can get that top five. The kitchen sink process is typically a reasonably large gamble. You know, just kind of coming up with something on the fly. You know, if you were all by yourself, it'd be tough. You know, the most common thing I think we see is taking from one of your teammates and saying, hey, we tried our way. It's just not working. We're going to change four shocks, springs, bars, tire pressures, wing angles, and just kind of go to where they are. And that does happen, but you want to do it early. You want to do it after the first session, after the second session. At some point, you have to get the driver in something that he's going to be familiar with the next time he gets in it. So it's not a big surprise to him, because you really got to let the drivers do their thing, you know. You get them close, they'll find you a little more usually. They're all pretty good at this level. But, yeah, it's something we for sure try and avoid. You can get lost sometimes when you only take some of what somebody else has, but not all. That can get you in a bind as well. Because, you know, there's a whole lot of things working together, right? And if you only take the parts you think you like, you might be missing what's actually working.
Mm. All right, we're going to close with the last question for you from our friend Vincent Anderson, who is a huge and longtime IndyCar supporter. And Vincent, I'll tip my hand. I'm not saying it is my favorite question, but this is a definite candidate for my favorite question of the week. It says, for Eric, and oh, I should also tell folks, you're Fernando Alonso's race engineer last year at Indianapolis. You guys didn't do too bad, by the way. Don't know if you noticed. For Eric, when Alonso was here, he was almost too amazing. But was there a time at Indy where he had a moment or question for you that made you think, that was odd for an F1 champ to say or do?
We ran into stuff that we take for granted every day, like just procedures, right? Like on the pit lane, you know, where you can do this or that, or pull from one lane to the other, and you know, stuff that, you know, we're around guys that do it all the time, and I don't even know what our drivers do, right? They just all do it the right way, whatever it was, but I've never had to ask before, right? So there was a few of those. I would find him sometimes out by the car, and he'd like wave me over. He's like, you know, hey, can we tape this or smooth this out or fill this in, right? Like he was looking at the car too, you know, just like all of us, trying to figure out where we could make it a little more slippery. So there's that. He was paying attention to some of the little stuff that you know, wow, you know, he was really into it. The one that really got my attention though last year was when we were watching this in-car footage from one of the drafting practices, and he came up on somebody in turn four and went and put the left sides on the white line, then below the white line, then into the grass, then from the grass over the manhole cover. I didn't even know was there. There's some drainage cover. Puts the thing like 40 degrees sideways, never lifted in the data, gets back in line behind the guys. He unwinds the wheel up onto the front straight, finishes the pass into turn one. So that one caught my eye. So that is the one really funny moment that kind of stuck out for me. And he was sitting next to me when we were watching the video, and I just looked at him and shook my head, and he just kind of smiled.
So your eyes are getting bigger watching this, and then after, I'm sure you look over him and said, "Bad Fernando, bad Fernando."
Yeah, he found some drainage cover that nobody even knew was there at 221 miles an hour. Crazy.
And I know how much fun you had. I mean, again, you've worked with some pretty amazing drivers, and I know how much you enjoyed working with him, because it was pretty clear that, yeah, he's brand new to ovals, but when you're working with that much natural talent plus the experience added on top, that guy was, you know, any thoughts of him being a rookie were kind of quickly thrown out the door, because, you know, you're working with one of the best in the world, period.
Oh, yeah. The approach, it was awesome to be around his approach and his thought process, and when he would get one thing mastered, he was already asking questions about the next thing. Like, it was awesome.
I'm just surprised he hasn't sent you a Kamoa skateboard or something to ride down pit lane in his absence or something like that. But, you know, he could send you a little something. Well, hey, Eric Bretzman, I can already tell I'm going to be getting a lot of great comments and DMs from folks saying, hey, you need to have him on more often, because you and I have been friends for a good while, and you know how much I appreciate you and your willingness to help me in what I do with answering questions, but I know my listeners are going to enjoy everything that you're able to share with us today, and I guess we'll just leave with, don't be a bully, man. You know, you guys could have won three races in a row with Rossi. Let someone else, you know, ease up a little bit. You guys kicked everyone's ass in Long Beach. Don't do it again at Barber. Yeah. That'd be mean.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm a little down already, because I always try and live by my buddy Ricky Davis over there at Ganassi. I always used to say, going to St. Pete, you can't win them all if you don't win the first one, and we didn't pull that one off. So.
All right, well, then disregard everything I said. Eric Bretzman, you rock, brother. Thank you again so much for joining us here on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, our weekend IndyCar presented by Cooper Tires. Well, friends, it is time for a podcast version of the Hamburger and French Fry Show. We were just following up here after speaking with our friend Eric Bretzman from Andretti Autosport. Sebastian Bourdais, tell us where you are. You're running around Southern California, man.
Yeah, I'm. I don't know how I got myself into this, but gonna record a show which is called the Daily Draw, and I'm gonna be all suited up and not quite sure what I'm supposed to do, but I'm posting it. So. I guess I keep working on my second career here.
Yeah, see? Look how far you've come since our first episode in Daytona in January. Well, you're going to be in front of about 60 million people, which is about 60 million more than we normally talk to, so don't screw up.
16, don't make me look better than
600.
It's a big jump from what I'm used to. From what I'm used to. So.
600 million people. That is pretty amazing, man. Well, all right. So if you missed the Long Beach Grand Prix and just looked at the race results, you might wonder why I'm talking to this loser here who finished 13th. I mean, come on, man. Middle of the pack. You could try a little bit harder, Bourdais. All kidding aside, man, the Cartoon Anvil had you and Hunter Ray just smack in its sights. What comes to mind, brother, after a day where I don't know if you're going to win, but it sure looked like you had a podium definitely in hand, and you come away with nothing? Have you had enough of these to where you just brush it off, or are you still waking up a little bit, you know, pissed at the world?
Not pissed at the world, pissed at a few different instances, a few different people. No, I mean, you know, unfortunately, I've had plenty of those, and you know, I've had reverse situations too, where I've benefited from strategy calls, which hung the leaders out, and we raced all the way back to second. Definitely didn't have anything for Rossi, who's been the class of the field the entire weekend. We look strong enough for second or third big battle with Scott Dixon, and we both come out of it. Caught out by a close bit again, and it's for sure pretty frustrating, but it's not unheard of, but the thing is, obviously, when you race your way from ninth all the way to second, pass a bunch of cars and show some really good race pace, it's always disappointing to come out of it 13th after a kind of a really eventful day. That analysis you made on the penalty where I had to give the position back to Scott. All I can say about it is that as far as I'm concerned, really, if you really want to officiate those kind of situations where honestly it's just brilliant TV, awesome racing, and just everybody is lucky enough to come out of it unscratched, either you leave it alone or then you just, you know, as far as I'm concerned, over-officiate, but then you might want to look at blocking rather than crossing a line, because, you know, I'm sliding down the outside. You clearly see those two cars down the inside, kind of taking care of themselves, and I'm getting a run from another world, and when I make my move going to the right side on the racing line, nobody's anywhere near me, and then all of a sudden, I think you can kind of see Scott's head kind of turning my way a little bit and be like, why is he coming, why is he coming that way, and where is he coming from?
Yeah, and that's the one thing I failed to point out, and that's, I guess I could blame all the medication I'm on, but that was one thing I failed to point out, but there was, I think it might have been the first or second screen capture where I think Dixie damn near sprained his neck, like snapping to the right to take a look to where you are, so, you know, he knew you were coming.
He's got one of the best spotters, too, he's got Robbie Fast in the radio, who's spotting for him, so...
Yeah.
Which is also why, to be honest with you, I felt very comfortable going there, because I'm sure Robbie was on the radio telling him exactly what was going to happen.
Robbie's a rock star, definitely rock star.
But he did, he's our spotter on the Ford with Joey and Dirk, and, I love him to death. I definitely didn't expect Scott to close the door as quick as he did when I was already committed. That's usually the definition of blocking an IndyCar, but for whatever reason they decided to judge the consequence instead of the cause, which was my biggest surprise, and my biggest frustration, disappointment, and everything in between, which unfortunately, a lot of people have read a lot of things, the good, the bad, the ugly, the I agree, I disagree, and anything in between. But truth be told, if you do put everything back in sequence, me having to give up that little advantage that I had pulled on Scott and reversing the position and then having to pass Scott again is far greater than the difference between making the pit commit line and not making it, which turns the race upside down and deprives the fan and the followers of the race of a heck of a battle and the last restarts.
Yeah.
So yes, I am quite aggravated.
Well,
but you can't wind the clock back, and there's nothing you can do. And then after that, it's a succession of poor judgment and very poor fairness on the racetrack from two people who didn't like my idiot comment.
Yeah, but, I was going to say, let's talk.
If you don't want to be called an idiot, if you don't want to be called an idiot, don't behave like an idiot. I'm sorry, but I'm not. It's just, it doesn't mean that I disrespect anyone or anything, but it's just an idiotic move that, you know, for the place we end up fighting for, you just don't, you know, it's not excusable to be raced that way. You know, whether you're lapped down and trying to dive bomb two guys that are fighting for position on the lead lap and turn the bystander around, or you fight dirty, you know, and close doors and bang wheels with guys that are just making, you know, fair attempts, it's not acceptable. I'm not okay with that, and I have no problem saying it, and I have no problem dealing with the consequences and the fire that some people may put on me just saying that I'm bad talking, rough mouthing, or whatever. You know, if they don't want to hear it, they don't have to read it. I'm fine with that.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask about. I mean, you, among the many things I enjoy about you, Mr. Bourdais, is you speak your mind, whether it's to drivers or whether it's to idiot journalists like myself. You know, you're your own man. You say what you think, and you stand by whether it's a consequences or praise. But I also know you don't say things by mistake. I mean, you're an intelligent guy. You think about what you say. When you call out folks and say, hey, you know, this guy was driving like an idiot, and this guy's bouncing off me like, you know, we're in a freaking jungle gym, do you go in, or do you do that, or do you say what you have to say and know that, all right, let me start the countdown, and when I get the phone call or the text from that angry person, or do you just, you know, really not care, say la vie?
No, honestly, I don't care. I mean, if people are not fair enough with themselves and other people to race fair and square and deal with the consequences when they don't, then I don't care. I just plain straight don't care. Like, you know, they can have it. It's fine, and we can all agree to disagree and whatever. It's on one day. It doesn't mean that I disrespect anyone or anything. You know, we can still go out and have a beer on the next weekend, whatever. But I'm gonna say what I gotta say on that particular instance, and it doesn't mean more than that. You know, and you read all those people, so-called drivers, or, you know, wannabes or whatever, who think that they would have reacted different, that they would, I didn't need to leave all the room, I didn't need to make those moves. Yeah, of course, I don't need to race either, you know. But when you're competitive and you have sponsors like Sealmaster and Hyde and, you know, all those guys, and you're racing for Honda at Long Beach, you're going to go for it. You know, you're going to make moves that are appropriate at the time. And everybody can make mistakes, but everybody has to deal with the consequences. And when I make a mistake, I raise my hand and I say, I'm sorry, ask for that. And I just like sometimes that, you know, people race you the same way and say, yep, he's right, I screwed up. And instead of, you know, Jordan comes to me after the race and apologizes. And I say, well, you know, everybody makes mistakes. Then you reach the comment that I kind of, you know, yeah, I was rough on the analysis because he deserves it. And now he's, you know, answering and kind of trying to be the smartass on Twitter. I'm sorry. It's like, you're a rookie, you're a lap down, you take me out. What do you think I'm going to say? Congratulations. You know? I mean, just suck it up, man. You made a mistake. You agreed to it. You apologize. Yeah, there's a tough comment on it. And so what? Don't you think you deserve it?
I
don't know.
It hasn't gone up yet. I don't think there's room for it yet, but in my little post-race analysis, hopefully it'll be up by Thursday. I'll let you know that Jordan, he's my first recipient of the Golden Bowling Ball Award this year. Actually, I think Rossi was at St. Pete, so I'm wrong, so he'd be the second winner of the Golden Bowling Ball. But yeah, that was interesting. Well, how's this? Let's close off the turn one, the pass, and we're still thinking, trying to think up a name. So, folks, send us your hashtag thoughts for what that should be called, because, you know, Zanardi obviously owns the pass from Laguna Seca. This one deserves a name of its own. So, I'm thinking hashtag the crossover, but maybe there's something better. But how's this, Seb?
Yeah, but I think, you know, the big thing I want to clarify is obviously none of this happens the way it did. If I get raced fair and not get thrown on the eggshells or the half moons or whatever you want to call them, those little
Well, that's what I was going to close off on.
Because all of a sudden, if I'm breaking on the line, I outbrake both Scott and Piggott who are down the inside, and I'm in control, and I probably don't go for the Foyt car, and I just do what I intended to do, which was pass car. And obviously, the fact that he dumps me on pit exit, now I'm out of control because I had to react. I couldn't hit the brake straight, and I'm bouncing off stuff that takes the car off the ground. So, of course, now I take evasive action on top of trying to save my life and not hit anyone. And yeah, it ends up being maybe the coolest move of the race, of the year, of this whatever century, if you want to call it, whatever. I don't care. But bottom line, none of this was intended. None of this would have ever happened had I been, you know, not dragged in that position, which I never asked for. So, you know, that's kind of the stuff that really kind of turns me like a little upside down, because it's just kind of giving, someone credit or intentions that were never his, and then on top of that you get nailed for something that you didn't do, which completes to wind me up. But you know, I guess, you know, I'm known to maybe, you know, overreact, call it whatever.
Oh, we love winding you up, but you know that, and you know you're learning to wind us up, so fair enough. Well, what I was going to say to close us off is, and I'm not taking sides, I'm just speaking honestly, as a racer, you would not have driven over the pit lane exit line had you been able to drive straight as you had intended. Obviously, Dixon, you know, was wanting to defend and move over, but there's a really basic premise here that had that move not happened, which then led to your move, you would not have been on that trajectory towards that line. Bottom line, coming down towards turn one, it was clear that at no point in time were you trying to intentionally go over to driver's right and flirt with that line to come close to having a penalty. It happened in reaction. But I'll also mention, and this isn't trying to defend anybody, but you know, the amount of time I've spent looking at this and folks have spent weighing in is a hell of a lot more than the Verizon IndyCar series spent, or, you know, I would say had in the booth to review this at super slow-mo. And, you know, I don't know how much time went into judging whether this was a penalty or not. It certainly was. Yeah.
To get it wrong is pretty good.
No, fair enough. The thing that bums me out is this should just be something we're talking about of, oh my goodness, how amazing was that? I hate the fact, which our friend and colleague Robin wrote about today, that instead we're talking about penalties and should it or shouldn't have been and blah, blah, blah. You know, anyways, that's a part to me that bums me out a bit. Well, hey, let's move on to questions. We have a little bit less time with you than we had hoped, but you have to talk to 1.6 billion people here on the show.
We're especially growing the audience.
Hey, you know, I'm just saying, the hamburger and french fry show, at least french fry is taking care of things here. And we already awarded swag from earlier when I was speaking with Eric Bretzman, when we get the questions from our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com. So thanks again to them. But let's move on to some questions here for Seb and fit in as many as we can before you tell us you have to run. Let's see. I love this. All right, Sebastian, were you confident that the front end was going to stick after you were making the pass, since it looked like from the outside there was a lot of things happening, both from entry speed and the front of the car bouncing around a bit? That comes in from J.D. Ellis. So how much was faith when you were pulling off that pass, and how much was the good Lord making sure you didn't hit anything?
Well, I'm not a believer, so that definitely doesn't come into play. But, yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, none of this was ever intended. It was never supposed to go down that way. I was forced down there and then did everything I could not to ruin anybody's day and not hurt anyone, including myself. So, yeah, I mean, I had no faith at all that I was going to get out of it unscratched, at all. It just, as soon as I get, you know, moved to the right and end up where I'm not supposed to be, yeah, it's all survival from there. Just got lucky, really.
All right, this one's from Sean Olmsted, and it just has to be answered. I answer it frequently, but you and I should need to weigh in on this because folks don't really have a full understanding. He said, this question's for everybody. Is there anyone in the current IndyCar paddock that can convince Robin Miller to join Twitter? My standard response is, which is his response, he can't afford to get fired, because he would be fired immediately with the amount of rants and cursing that he goes on. But I work with him every day. Seb, can you share with folks the average Robin Miller, the type of average Robin Miller conversation, not the one on the record, but the off-the-record stuff that, if he was on Twitter, would probably be posted about every 5 minutes? I mean, he'd get hauled off to jail, right?
Yeah, I think there's not many people that it would not be on the trap list, that's for sure. So, you know, I mean, I think if I'm unfiltered, Robin is about a level 10 to a level 1 for me. So, yeah, I think that could be really entertaining, although it'd probably be pretty detrimental for him.
Well, no one would ever talk to him again on pit lane. He'd be the guy with the quietest microphone, because every single person, probably me included, would be mad at him. All right, here's a question from Dan Leans, and I hope I didn't just murder your last name, Dan. He says, Seb, what are your plans after you hang up your helmet? Any aspirations for team ownership in IndyCar or any other series? He says, personally, I think commentary would be absolutely awesome, and I agree on that last part.
Honestly, I haven't given it much thought. I keep getting asked the question more and more. Obviously, I'm 39 and I'm not getting any younger. So I probably really should start thinking about what next. And just the way I am, the way I function, I have a very difficult time projecting and planning the future outside of racing. Trying to stay focused or being focused on what I'm doing right now, which is racing. I don't know. I think in the future, short term, medium term, long term, I don't know. Whenever I will be done with racing, for one reason or another, I'll switch my mind and go after something else, which is probably poor planning and quite stupid, to be honest. But I can't quite do things half-assed, and I can't really see myself doing the transition or doing both at the same time. Or when I'll do the transition and prepare the future, I don't think I'll be performing to my expectations.
Well, that's when we can start our media empire and take over the world. But just tell me when. Just give me a one-day notice when you're going to retire, so you know I can file all the paperwork for the corporation. All right, your fellow Florida resident Vincent Anderson says, question, how much has driving on I-4 helped you with that amazing pass?
Yeah, you'd be very surprised. I do my very extreme, very best at trying not to participate in any of the idiocy that happens on the road. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm lucky enough to have to deal with that on the racetrack. I don't do any of that. And I really try and treat the road as much as I can for the use it is, which is going from point A to point B safely with the family. No, not relevant for that.
Maybe there was somebody in like a little souped-up Honda Civic that pulled off that pass one day that you watched, and you're like, okay, I'm going to do that at Long Beach, turn one. All right, let's see. Jerry.
No, that's where the idiot comments comes out.
Well, see, Twitter would be, you'd just be ripping people apart if you knew their names. All right, Jerry Sudduth asks, or says, Sebastian, thank you for such a determined drive on Sunday. That was inspiring to watch. And Jerry asks, how did the different rubber compounds laid down by all the different series affect the handling of the car on Sunday? And that's a question we get somewhat often, Seb. So can you speak to maybe the amount of time it takes for Firestone rubber to kind of make its own home of the racetrack after you're following, you know?
That's an interesting question, and that's always something I try to stay on top of with Craig and Olivier. What series been running in front of us. It seemed like post truck series on the Stadium Trophy trucks and post IMSA, the track was incredibly slippery, and post World Challenge, the track was actually in pretty good shape, which is all to do with rubber compatibility or incompatibility. So always quite interesting, different tire manufacturers' interaction on the track.
Interesting. Kevin Frederico asks me, how do I feel about Rossi entering the mid-stretch of the season, and do I think he can keep the momentum of a championship run? I mean, based on what we've seen from the Andretti organization so far, Seb, it looks like they've come out of the gates this season really strong, across two street circuits that are very different, plus a short oval. We know they're usually strong at Indianapolis. Rossi and his engineer Jeremy Millis seem to be in a good place. I mean, Kev, how's this? I don't know if Rossi is ready for a championship run. That is something that usually takes a little bit more experience to get there, because building a championship, you know, it usually just doesn't happen by mistake. There's usually some intentional, you know, a mindset that goes into it. I think if anything this year, what's going to happen going forward, that's going to be the thing to watch. You know, has this kid, still fairly young but very experienced, is he ready to step up and be that guy who's willing to accept, you know, fourth place instead of a dive bomb pass that might get him second but has a really bad risk and reward ratio? So I don't have an answer for that yet, but I think that's actually your question is the one we should be tracking for the season to see if he is at that place yet. Let's see. Now, this is a great one from Matt Busby. Ask Seb how he gets his pants on in the morning. That's a good question considering the balls you needed last weekend, Seb. Let's see. Interesting here. Says this one comes in from Brian Smith. He says, Sebastian, we've heard the evolution of this year's car is a lot like or similar to the champ cars you won four titles in. Brian asks, how does this car actually compare to those champ cars that you used to drive?
No, it doesn't. The floor on the champ cars was very different. We had tunnels. Car was a lot better behaved, a lot easier to set up. That particular car we're using right now is a really great design exercise. The car looks cool, although I'm still completely in love with the panels. I think it was probably one of the coolest looking, slickest cars I've ever driven, and definitely the best handling road car I've ever driven on the road course. Just very, very different. That current aero bodywork that we're using is, there were a lot of constraints. Bill and Tino did a really good job to make it race well, which was, you know, the like we talked about before, the main objective. And it does. Clearly, you can follow a heck of a lot better than we used to. Turbulence is nowhere near as bad. It allows for cool and entertaining racing, but as far as balance and center pressure migration and how hard it is to get that car in the zone, and you see it. I mean, all you got to do is watch Rossi's inboard camera, and honestly, I'm not leaking his butt right now. It's just honestly, it still boggles my mind that he has not crashed yet, because he does about two or three corrections per corner, and that car looks absolutely diabolical evil. Yet, he pulls that time out of it and runs away with an incredible pace. So, kind of going back to the question a little bit that you answered, I think every contender that wants to give him a run for his money and challenge him for the championship where he's comfortably in the lead right now, seems to be, and even Power said it, it's going to be tough. I think he's stepped up his game a heck of a lot. He's willing to take chances. I think the only chance that we all might have is if he makes a big mistake and loses confidence, because right now he's full of it and he's driving like a man possessed. So it's going to be quite exciting.
Hashtag, I'm not licking his butt. That might be the best quote of the week so far, Seb. All right, we got time for one or two more questions before we need to cut you loose so you can go talk to 6 billion people. All right, so we already covered this a little bit, but it might be a quick one. This comes in from Tim Updegrove. He says, Seb, when drivers make a mistake and take someone out, does the offending driver come by after the race to apologize or talk? And we know that, you know, you mentioned that Jordan came by, but in general, is this something where you see IndyCar drivers at least try to do things face-to-face, phone call, text? Do some just not even bother coming over? I mean, what are the policies of making good with one another?
No rules. No rules. Everybody, there's no etiquette. Everybody deals with it whichever way he wants. I think Takuma probably is one of the the most honest guy with the way things work. You know, he's, we've had a couple of incidents, and I've seen him come and apologize and being meaningful about it. But yeah, I mean, there are some guys who are never wrong and can never raise their hand and say they screwed up, and certainly even more in front of a camera or a microphone, and won't even bother coming to you and apologizing. So there's everybody's different, and yeah, it is kind of what it is.
All right, last question is going to go to Martin Henderson, and I like this one. This, some thought was put into this one, Seb. He says there's 10 laps remaining and you're leading the Indy 500 when you suddenly feel a little loose in the cockpit. He says you look down and your safety harness has come undone. Do you pit to get it fixed, or do you keep driving and hope for everything to work out and hopefully go on and win the Indy 500? And do you tell anyone?
I
know.
I sure hope that never happens. I don't think sanity comes into play at that point. Unfortunately, I best hope that my wife doesn't listen ever to that podcast.
She has better taste.
I don't think you pit, but I mean, it's something you have to. It's something you have to kind of deal with the situation when it happens. But it's happened to me before, that one lap belt came undone, and I did keep going, which probably was not the smartest thing I've ever done, but.
It's one thing if it's the Iowa Corn 300. It's another thing if it's the Indy 500. So, understood. Well, I've been calling you a hashtag Sealmaster Bourdais all season. I think I'm going to have to switch that up. I think I'm going to have to start calling you hashtag Passmaster Bourdais after your insane move. Well, brother, thank you for finding some time between a fairly busy day here in Southern California, and I won't get to see you in Barber, but hopefully we have lots of positive things to talk about next week, and just awesome to see some of the smaller teams not just have one good day in the sun, but to see you and the team fighting strong at Phoenix, here again at Long Beach, so hopefully the mighty Dale Coyne Racing team can keep humbling some of the wealthier and larger programs.
Hey, man. Get well soon, and miss you, Hamburger.
All right. French fry. Talk to you soon.